This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University.
And I'm Brand Ruttinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Jay, we've got a big week this week, as it seems we always do. We are in the home stretch of the very consequential midterm
Puffy
elections.
Taco bets, Brandon.
I'm looking forward to it because I've got some predictions here I think are going to be spot on, but we'll have to wait and see until we get into the deep. But we've got a lot to talk about nationally. Unfortunately, it begins with something that is happening and too common now, and that is a shooting in Pittsburgh of Jewish worshipers at the Tree of Life Synagogue. Jay, give us a little background on what happened, and let's talk about the political implications potentially to the midterms.
Sure. We had an anti-Semitic white nationalist go into a conservative synagogue in the Pittsburgh area and killed 11 parishioners and wounded several others, including officers who were there trying to stop it. The background of it is horrific. We've had so many of these mass shootings, but the political elements and the political aspects, I think, are something that we want to talk about here on this show. When President Trump, who went there to do a condolence call, he tried to bring folks together. His initial reaction, I think, was by some people viewed negatively, where he called for sort of armed guards and houses of worship. There was an open letter by Jewish organizations from Pittsburgh telling the president not to come. And it's turned into sort of this larger question of the role of language and the president's seeming sort of inability at times to distance himself from alt-right figures.
Yeah.
Whether or not he's contributing to a negative climate, this kind of dovetails into a little bit with what happened with the pipe bombing, where it turns out that the person who was sending that was in fact a Trump supporter.
Yeah. It's, I think, an unfortunate case that it was a missed opportunity for the president to soothe the nation's nerves and to calm down the temperature of the rhetoric that has been way too hot for way too long. Now, it's clear the president is part of this problem. There's no doubt about it, right? He's essentially suggested at rallies that people be, you know, punched and hurt, and they have been. The rhetoric, even beyond that, has been awful. In fact, even in the days after this happened, you had the president ridiculing one of the targets of the pipe bomber, one of the members of the Democratic Party. So this is something which needs to end. It's difficult to see how it could end in these very polarized times, but the opportunity, I think, was missed. And I think the Republicans probably largely lament that the president didn't do more here. But I think that as it is, it just kind of gets swept up in the rest of the chaos of the election. My sort of point on this was that it's funny that the issue didn't become about guns, right? That's something that typically happens after these, and that hasn't happened here. So I wonder what you think about that, and if that's something to come, or if it's just that it get washed away in the sort of grand scheme of all of the kind of confusion and chaos of the election.
I think that's a really great point, Brandon, you're raising about the fact that we're not talking about guns. The individual in question legally purchased high capacity weapons. It was an AR-15 was the weapon that he used, which was previously banned and when we had an assault weapons ban. That's just conversations not being had. This
right.
is not like what happened in Parkland, where it immediately became about guns. I think a lot of it is this underlying question of anti-Semitism and how much the president sort of played in it. It was ironically the year anniversary from Sutherland Springs that we had here in Texas.
Yeah.
After what happened in Charlottesville with the alt-right neo-Nazi rally and the way the president was sort of chastised for dealing with that, this happens. It all became about the politics around how the president has embraced certain fringe elements and used them to kind of push certain buttons. I'm not sure that it really would get to it, and I think it's because of politics. But I want to keep with this idea about the president pushing buttons, because I think it's really important. Because we've seen that again here, Brandon.
Yeah.
The president of the United States is now President Trump has floated out the idea of ending birthright citizenship that has been enshrined since 1868 in the 14th Amendment of the right. Constitution.
And sanctified by the Supreme Court, right?
Right, sanctified by the Supreme Court in multiple cases. I'm not sure what's going on here, but it has created a firestorm, and it plays right into kind of this electioneering that he's doing.
That's right. I think it is completely, like, ridiculous to suggest that this happen. It is so fundamentally part of the constitutional structure that it seems unlikely that it would be undone. Of course, it's about politics. To me, though, there's too much head nodding on this from fellow Republicans, and I think that they hadn't gone far enough to kind of challenge the president on this. Now, Paul Ryan, to some degree, kind of pushed back, saying, like, this is not something we plan to do, because really, if it's going to change, Congress has to change it, right? So that's
right.
Very unlikely.
And it's even more complicated than that. I know there's the only question is whether or not congressional authorization or congressional change would be enough, or whether or not it would require an actual amendment to the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
My view of it from a legal perspective is that it would, and not just mine, Neil Katyal, who is the former Solicitor General under Obama, and George Conley, who is a celebrated conservative lawyer and happens to be the husband of Kellyanne Conway.
Makes George for an awkward
yes,
dinner.
Yes, 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 George Conway.
That night.
Penned an op-ed in the Washington Post where they essentially argued that you need a constitutional amendment to do this. You can't do this by executive order. You can't do it by congressional action. And so any notion that this is an easy step or the president can do it is just utter nonsense. But I think this is just the president playing politics. And he understands that. He floated this out there. Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas, who's locked in a heated battle against Beto O'Rourke, came out, has historically said that he's for this, changing it. The Governor Greg Abbott here in Texas also said he needed to study this issue.
Right.
The man was the Attorney General of Texas, a former Texas Supreme Court justice. It's kind of nonsensical here.
You haven't studied it yet, right?
Yeah, you would think he's read the 14th Amendment just once or twice.
Right. Well, to me, it's interesting because, like, think about the alternative happening. President Hillary Clinton says that we should undo this constitutional element by executive order, and like the earth spins off its axis.
Oh, right? Imagine, like, the Second Amendment changed, right?
Yeah.
By executive order, right, by President Clinton. There would be riots in the streets.
But you're right. I think a lot of this is just politicking, right? It's base stoking. 61% of Republicans in Texas believe that this is one of the top two issues. That's something that is repeated nationwide. I don't think it's going to go anywhere, but it's certainly something that is designed to evoke a response from the base, not unlike another of the president's announcements this week, which was that he planned to deploy 15,000 troops to the U.S.-Mexico border. The Pentagon already reports that they're sending about 7,000 to reach a max of about 8,000, and the president has basically one-upped that even more. The president characterized the events that are happening in South America as an invasion. He talked about essentially establishing a wall of people to prevent that invasion from happening with very little evidence. Jay, what are the political implications to this? Because this is obviously, like, the hottest issue and is going to be the most talked about issue in the midterms.
Yeah, so let's be really clear about this first and foremost. There is no invasion.
Right.
The U.S. We
talked about this last week,
yes,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. There is no invasion at all. The Mexican ambassador to the United States has already been on the record as saying about a little over 3,000 people is who they see in this convoy. Reason magazine, the libertarian think tank that sort of went down and tracked them, 65% of the people there are women and children. There's no one of Middle Eastern origin. There's nobody from ISIS in this convoy. Of the 3,000 plus that are there, 1,800 have already been offered asylum in Mexico. Another half that of remaining amount have essentially dispersed. We're talking about fewer than a few hundred people that are making their way now up to the border.
Still, you like our odds, though, in that.
Yeah,
right?
I like our 15,000.
15,000.
So, but let's be clear,
well-trained,
about,
you know, troops against the 1,500. I don't
yeah,
know.
Yeah, and not to mention the troops can't even do anything.
Right, right.
We have a law called Posse Comitatus that essentially prevents the U.S. military from ever being used on U.S. soil.
Yeah.
And so they're literally there to stand around and provide support.
As the president said, a wall of people, right? Yeah, I mean, they can help in terms of planning, coordination. They can offer medical support, right? They can deal with some of their transportation issues. But there's not much else they can do. So again, this is a bit of a Hail Mary for the president, and of course it comes at just the right moment. The concern for the president and for Republicans is that they're not getting the numbers in terms of turnout that they want. That's something we'll talk about in Texas, but we'll also obviously see this happening across the country. And so this is something which they're worried about, and this is the most extreme way to describe this and to try to get their Republicans out, but it could end up working.
Well, and you know, that's the unfortunate thing, right? They've already said that they famously want to frame this election as Kavanaugh, the caravan, and tax cuts, right? That's what that's the big three punch for them.
Yeah.
Tax cuts, if you look at the polling data, isn't really working. The Brett bump looks like it's faded dramatically from the confirmation. But the caravan and immigration has been their kind of their go-to, right?
Yeah.
That's the Old Faithful when the chips are down to try to gin up the base. We'll see if it works or doesn't work. There's some pretty provocative ads out there now on it. But the president, I think, is throwing it. They are concerned about losing the House because they know things will change dramatically. And so some of these other Senate races and gubernatorial races, I think this is sort of ground zero on that.
Yeah.
Well, Brandon, we've got another potential scandal erupting here, and this is a scheme that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, has essentially exposed, which is that there was a group of individuals out there trying to pay for dirt on him to accuse him of sexual harassment and a means to try to undermine this investigation. It was found out, apparently it wasn't a very well-constructed scheme. I was found out, turned over, now they're investigating, and now there is embarrassment all around.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't even finished eating all of our, you know, trick-or-treat Snickers yet, but it seems like Halloween continues, right? The sort of ridiculousness seems to have no boundaries in politics anymore. I think the problem is not so much that it's happening, because like you said, they caught it, and it was so ill-prepared that it didn't really have any legs anyway. But the problem is that these kinds of scandals, these kinds of conspiracy theories have a way of sticking in people's minds. Now, we know that from a lot of literature on misinformation that when people are told something it's not true, they may still believe it even after they're told it wasn't true or there's a correction issued. This is the nature of fake news, and it's contributing to the ideological pole that people are living in, right? That they have their own facts, they essentially have their own arrangement, and this is the kind of thing that can stick. So it doesn't have to be true for it to be impactful. But I'm just glad it's not something that is going to be a serious issue.
Well, the flip side of that now is that if there, in fact, were something that came out on Robert Mueller, I think the question would people believe it?
Interesting.
So you've got this sort of interesting inoculation that may have occurred because they're now going to be questioning the veracity of anything that was critical against him.
Well, speaking of questioning, the president apparently is a baseball fan. Now, Jay, we should start this by saying that we should congratulate begrudgingly the Boston Red Sox for the World Series championship, which they just won from the LA Dodgers. The president had some opinions about what precisely should happen, and maybe after he's done in the White House, he'll go into managing.
I don't think that's happening anytime soon. And let's be clear, the real World Series already took place. It was called the American League Championship Series, and the defending champion Astros unfortunately fell. But, you know, we will fight another day. But yes, he decided in this World Series game, he decided to criticize the manager for pulling the pitcher Rich Hill, who looked like he was going strong, and it ended up backfiring on the Dodgers.
Yeah.
Became the longest game, I think, in World Series history.
Right.
The Red Sox won and then decided to romp the rest of the way through the series.
The president questioned the wisdom of taking out a pitcher who was starting after a few innings, saying, managers do this all the time, big mistake. I'm actually going to side with the president on this one because I, as a Cubs fan, I remember many a game where Rich Hill would simply just fall apart after the fifth inning. So I'm not sure that this wasn't such a bad idea. And you have to be situational, obviously. But you know what? It's baseball. It's fun. That's what makes it exciting. So congrats to the Red Sox and all Red Sox Nation. Well, we've spent enough time talking about the Red Sox and what happens in New England. Let's talk Texas, Jay.
We've got
an interesting race for speaker shaping up. What's going on?
Well, you know, for months, I'd like to say even years, but then I wouldn't even be true, Brandon, since Speaker Strauss didn't say anything until the last few months. But I have been talking about the fact that Dennis Bonin from Friendswood, state representative and House committee chair, was going to be the next speaker. And everyone kept telling me, there's no way, because Dennis Bonin said, I'm not running. Well, guess what? He's running.
Stop believing people when they say they're not running.
Stop believing when they tell you, right. So it made perfect sense. He is he was close to the speaker, but he's liked by sort of more conservative factions and moderate factions there. He's probably the one guy who can bring folks together. And he's now emerged as a front runner, has a group of people, about 25 or so, that have hard committed to him. We don't know exactly who they are. And in typical politician fashion, he was recruited to run, so he's begrudgingly running.
Oh, yes, exactly. So there are other members who are running, too. We've got six active members, including Travis Clardy, Drew Darby, Phil King, Tan Parker. The situation is that the Republicans are going to meet after the election. The winner has to have two-thirds support of the voting people. But if there are multiple ballots and that number goes down, the question here is Dennis Bonin somebody who can attract enough support from both conservative and moderate elements? The question here, I think, also is complicated because the Democrats are going to do well, and we'll see how well you think they're going to do, but the Democrats are going to do well in the election, right? So the goal for the rule change essentially was to keep the Republican Party unified and the Democrats in the dark. But if the Republicans can't unify behind a speaker choice before the election, they're going to have a lot more problems dealing with the insurgent, you know, kind of revitalized Democrats after the election. So I think part of this is a play to be able to get this organized. Initially, it was reported Bonin had 40 people. It looks like maybe more like it's 25. He's, though, been donating to other members, I think, with the expectation that he can soften some ground and get some yeses in his pocket. So we'll see how this shakes out. But there are still too many people in this race to call it sort of for Dennis Bonin.
I certainly don't want to imply it's a done deal. I guess the other thing we need to mention is that John Zerwas, who was the sort of the defined kind of moderate speaker's person in this race, pulled himself out as Bonin comes in. And so the presumption is the 12 to 15 or so more moderate members that Zerwas had are likely to align themselves with Bonin.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other part of it, as you said, is that the fact that the Democratic caucus is likely to get bigger. Of the list that we mentioned, Bonin's probably the one guy that they might be more satisfied. And interestingly enough, Bonin didn't sign that pledge that says that he will have to abide by that. So it'll be interesting to see moving forward what happens. Mm-hmm. But we've also got other stuff going on in Texas. Congressman Henry Cuellar down in Laredo is in a bit of a brouhaha over allegations that a staffer was fired over a pregnancy. So what's happened here, Brian?
Yeah, that's right. Representative Cuellar essentially is being investigated for whether or not his employee's rights were violated with respect to her pregnancy. The individual here claims that that she has been terminated on the basis of job performance, but she says that it was only brought up after she implied that she was trying to take maternity leave. Now, Representative Cuellar has been in some political issues lately. He's one of the more conservative Democrats from the coalition and was, as you recall, the subject of some heat from fellow Democrats after he essentially set up a fundraiser and breakfast for John Carter, who is an incumbent Republican who's running a pretty tough race against MJ Hager. So Cuellar is no sort of stranger to some of these complications, but certainly this doesn't bode well. He is not, I think, in jeopardy of losing his seat. But once again, we see another sort of scandal pop up here, which could be problematic for him going forward, potentially for Democrats going forward. Hey, speaking of scandal, here in Harris County, several Republicans think that there's a voter fraud issue. Now, what is the basis of this, Jay?
So our good friend, State Senator Paul Bettencourt, has been leading the charge on this. And the senator and Stan Stannard, the Harris County clerk, issued out a press conference. And after an investigation, it was determined that about 60 or 70 or so people have private mailboxes at UPS stores.
Yeah.
Which is not uncommon, right? So the way, and the issue here is essentially, simply put, is that you're not supposed to be registered to vote at a commercial business.
Mm-hmm.
Simultaneously, you cannot be registered to vote at a U.S. post office box. Where the argument is coming into play is there may or may not be a gray area with private mailboxes as an alternative address.
Yeah.
And so the question is this a loophole that needs to be closed? Is this actual voter fraud? Are people using it to vote in a district or a area in which they don't actually physically reside?
Yeah.
These are all sort of valid questions and not ones that shouldn't be raised. But we've had record turnouts, and I think the only question I would have is, I'm not sure 80 people constitutes extensive voting fraud and should be used to undermine the system. I think the larger question is why this isn't being looked into, and if it requires legislative action, then I'm sure Senator Betancourt will be happy to file that bill.
If only he knew somebody who could do that, right? Yeah, I think you're exactly right. We're going to see some changes to the law. But this is actually consistent with the way Republicans have approached the voting fraud issue, right? The party's really stepped up efforts to combat mail fraud, especially through the mail. That's something we have seen in a couple cases coming out of Fort Worth. What's interesting to me is that people pay like virtually zero attention to the administrative process of elections, but it is the core foundation of how we vote and is really the cornerstone of democracy. This is not the first time that the Republicans have challenged voters in Harris County, right? Not but a few months ago, there was a concern from the ballot security committee from Harris County Republican Party who said that there were a bunch of people who were not registered properly and should be suspended. Then there was a kind of back and forth with Ann Bennett's office with respect to whether they should be removed or not. And so it became kind of a problem. The process is really tricky. I mean, the law is fairly clear, but the implementation has been a little bit spotty. So that process is important, and I think we need to pay attention to it. I mean, I don't know what the resolution will be or should be, but I do know that this needs to be paid attention to because this is as important as who votes, right? Because it really gets to determine who gets to vote.
Well, Brandon, we've got a few more days left till Election Day. Money, money, money is still rolling in. They're still asking, what do the 8-day funding reports tell us? Anything popped up for you? Who's up, who's down?
A couple interesting things. I mean, we'll talk about competitive races in a moment here, but there are a few that are in North Texas that struck my attention. One is John Turner outraised Lucy Luby Ryan by about 50,000. That's going to be an interesting race. Julie Johnson has outraised Matt Rinaldi in House District 115. And that's been, I think, important. Rinaldi, I think, has like got the biggest target on his back. So that money is something that's going to be pretty impactful. I think for the Republicans, though, that Victoria Nevey may be in some issue. That's a district out of Dallas. It's essentially a district which is pretty flippable. And so the fact that she's outraising and outspending by a little bit is, I think, pretty telling. What about General Paxton, though, right? He pulled in a bunch of money, and Justin Nelson, his challenger for attorney general, spent a bunch of money.
Yeah, that's the one that caught my eye. It just in the sense of two ways. One, Paxton's really turned it on as far as trying to run an actual race.
Right.
Most interesting thing I noted was that he's spending a lot of money himself.
Yeah.
Lots of negative ads now against Justin Nelson. So General Paxton is kind of feeling the heat there.
Yeah.
On a macro level, most of the contested races, the Democrats have done very well.
Yeah.
On the congressional races in the Houston area, CD22, Sri Kulkarni has way outraised. Pete Olson continues to.
Yeah.
Lizzie Fletcher's continuing to outraise John Culberson. So you're seeing that sort of macro trend continue.
Yeah.
But Brandon, let's just dive right into some of these and shift in gears a bit and talk midterm races. We've got Taco Bets on the horizon here. So what?
I can taste it now,
Jay. You can taste it now. So let's do it this way here. Before we get to the quick lightning round, let's talk about the big races at the top of the ticket, then talk maybe some legislative races here in Texas, and then talk national races. So with that, let's go. Let's start big. Let's talk Beto O'Rourke, Ted Cruz. What do you see happening, and what's your prediction?
Cruz plus 5. Maybe higher if straight ticket voting holds. And this is really the key, I think. To me, we're going to watch two things. Number one, let's watch the suburbs. Collin County, Montgomery County, Williamson County, you've got more core Democratic voters than you've got Republican voters. So not number-wise, but percentage-wise. That is, I think, where Democrats are going to potentially make up some difference. So that's why the race is closer. And then the Latino vote. 19% so far in early voting in 2018. That's up from about 15% in 2014. So those two factors may be the biggest impact on the race, which is, I think, why it's 5 or 6. That's my final guess.
That's your final guess. So I'm going to go Cruz minus 5.
What?
So I'm calling for the big upset. So here's my thought process. The trend line in some of the likely voter polling has moved towards O'Rourke over the last couple of weeks. And that, in some ways, I think, is indicated by the fact that the Cruz folks have really ramped up the negative attacks on O'Rourke. The numbers in terms of the raw numbers of votes so far cast early have dramatically sort of favored, particularly in some of the suburban counties.
Okay.
A lot of the Democrats running, a lot of that's from O'Rourke. Huge increase in turnout of 18 to 35 voters. I think that favors O'Rourke. that's probably not enough to get him over the hump.
Okay.
But I definitely think it's moving in a direction that's going to surprise people. So I think under 5, but probably not by much.
Wow.
Just right around there.
That's the upset of the nation, right? That is like national news.
Yeah. I mean, I think Cruz wins it, but he wins it by 4.5 to 5.
Okay.
Anything less than that, then we're just, you know, we're in uncharted territory here. But that's my take on it. We got a taco to go. What's your? let's skip over the governor's race because then it's just a margin of do you think he's winning by 15 or 20?
Yeah.
Let's go with the AG race. That's the other one we talked about.
I think that's going to be interesting. I have Paxton by 11, but I have everybody else, Abbott, Patrick, Hager by about 17. So in effect, the AG race is much closer, but not close enough. I think that straight ticket voting is going to be essentially what's driving much of this. You say Republicans, you say Democrats are enthused. I think that's true. Republicans are also enthused. And so I'm not convinced that you're going to see that margin there. I think if Nelson had another month to hammer Paxton on the indictment issue, on the ethics issue, the crime issue, I think that would be potentially within the margin of error here. But as it is, I don't think he's there.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that race may get a little bit under 10. I'm thinking 9 or 8. This is one where Democrats are going to wake up the next morning and say, if we had figured it out and spent the money in that race, that race would be something else. Because if you had just let people know that Ken Paxton is under criminal indictment, I think you'd have a vastly different result. But as is, there's just not much there.
Yeah.
The down ballot race is the disadvantage he has is he's not Beto O'Rourke in terms of general name ID for Justin Nelson. You're seeing... I think where you have the situation where you have some Republicans that are generally switching for the Senate race, that straight ticket's going to be carrying him through there.
Let's talk U.S. Congress. How many seats, if any, will the Democrats pick up?
I'm going to say the Democrats will pick up a total of 2.
Okay.
And the two races are, this is the one that's going to surprise
me.
I'm going to say CD7, Lizzie Fletcher is going to beat John Culberson.
Okay, I'm going to make a note right here.
You're going to make a note. And
I'm going to say
Colin Allred's beating Pete Sessions,
which
would mean that I think Will Hurd is going to hold on.
I have the same. I think Democrats pick up 3 with an asterisk. We pick up, they pick up 7, they pick up 32, and they pick up 21. I'm going to say that Copster beats Chip Roy.
That is the upset special.
That's
one race. That's a good call, Brandon.
What about the ledge? How many House seats, Senate seats are we going to see in play?
I see 1 Texas Senate seat flipping.
Okay.
I think Don Huffines is gone. Nathan Johnson's going to win that seat. And I think Lucido gets close down in 17, but not enough.
Mm-hmm.
I think
what about Connie Burton and Bev Powell
I think Connie Burton's going to hold on to that seat. That's I just think it's close, but not close enough. I think on the House side, the Democrats are going to pick a total of 5 up.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't look like in Harris County they have a good shot. I think Workman's probably gone in the Austin area.
Really?
I think Rinaldi loses in the Dallas area. Dallas is really where I think you see some movement because there's just, as a county, they've moved dramatically to the left.
I'm going to say the same. I think 1 Senate seat, Huffines, maybe 2. I think the 10, the Bev Powell and Senator Burton race is going to be very close. I'm going to say 7 in the House. That includes Rinaldi, Ryan, Coop, Anderson, Dale, and a couple others. So that's a pretty
John
good...
John Turner. We've got about John
actually,
Turner.
That's a good one, too.
Yeah, we've got about John Turner.
So, you know, that's a for the Democrats, that's a good midterm, right? Where normally that's not going to be so good for them. So we'll watch the trends, Jay. Excited as everybody else, but there's certainly a lot to talk about. It's going to be an exciting couple of days.
Well, very quickly, nationally, I say that the U.S. House flips to the Democrats.
Yes.
Republicans hold on to the Senate, and we have a brand new world come Wednesday morning.
It's going to be interesting to see how Trump will deal with an opposition Congress, right? Considering how contentious it is, even when he's got a unified Congress, right, I think we're going to see even more of this vitriol. So that's to come.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our coordinating producer, number one on your ballot, Ernie Manous. Special kudos to our web and graphics team at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer and top vote getter, Todd Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.